So today what we're going to do is talk about the 10 Canadian guidelines I think you should know. And as I told most of you, this comes from a presentation that I created because students and residents don't necessarily know what the normal blood pressure is, what normal sugar is. And so we're going to go through some common things that why your parents wanted you to go to medical school so that you can answer these questions. So we're going to review how well you know our Canadian guidelines and give you the resources at the end so that way you can read them on your own later. So I put a disclaimer at the beginning. These are guidelines. Guidelines are guidelines are guidelines, and patients are individuals. Guidelines are created on a population level, and you always have to understand and decide whether or not these guidelines are applicable to the person sitting in front of you. Guidelines also change frequently, and you have to be keeping up to date with them in order to make sure that you are giving your patients the most up-to-date information and treating them the way that you probably should be. So, the test that you both, that you all just wrote, these are the statistics from about a year's worth of medical students at McGill and how well they've done. As you can see, a lot of people knew about their high blood pressure and when to start a mammogram, and like I was mentioning, anything over 75% I think people do pretty well. But pretty much all the other guidelines are not as good. And so we're going to go through these today and hopefully you'll all score better on your post-test. So, how well do you know your Canadian guidelines? So we're going to go through them one at a time. And this is the hypertension guideline, hypertension.ca, if you want to go easy. Anything with a big important thing usually has its own website. These were updated in the past couple of weeks, actually, so you're the first group that gets the new version of this talk. So there's some key messages from the CHEP guidelines, which is the Canadian Hypertension Education Program. And I'll highlight this one, that the target blood pressure is 140 over 90. And if you have diabetes or chronic kidney disease, it's 130 over 80. And we'll talk a little bit about the new guidelines that were in this one that weren't in the ones last year. In order to be diagnosed with high blood pressure, though, how do you get diagnosed? So hypertension on the first visit, if you are encephalopathic or confused and you're having chest pain or any change in mental status, that's a hypertensive emergency. You don't have to wait for the second, third, fourth visits to diagnose that person with high blood pressure. However, if you are more than 180 over 110 and no hypertensive urgency, you can bring them back for a second visit. If they're still that high or they're higher than 140 over 90 and have end organ damage, they have high blood pressure and you treat. Otherwise, you bring them back for visit 3, 4, and 5, depending on how high their blood pressure is to begin with. You can do a 24-hour ambulatory blood pressure monitor where you wear the blood pressure for 24 hours. And if your awake average is 135 over 85, that's good. If at night you don't dip between 130 over 80, that's also not good. At home, we give you 5 points for being nervous at your doctor's office. So at home, people who take their blood pressure should be 135 over 85. So these are some new things that they're putting in because they now know that a lot of people are using a lot of these automated blood pressure monitors, and we know here at the Jewish we use a lot of BP Trues. I don't know if they use it at St. Mary's or the other places, where it takes the first reading, drops it, and then takes an average of the next 4 or 5 readings at 1 to 2 minute intervals. And actually, this is the first year where they actually say the normal for that is 135 over 85. So you, again, lose your 5 points for being nervous at the doctor's office if you use the BP True monitor. So when someone does a BP True and it's 138 over 87, that is actually still technically high blood pressure and probably deserves attention. So where do people get blood pressure disease? So 4 big areas, brain, eyes, heart, kidney disease, and of course also peripheral arterial disease as well. And so what do they recommend as a screening for patients with hypertension? They recommend a urinalysis, blood chemistry, potassium, sodium, and creatinine, fasting glucose, fasting cholesterols, and a 12-lead EKG. Why are they doing the 12-lead EKG? What would you see on an EKG that would be a sign of high blood pressure or end organ damage due to high blood pressure? Preferably not an MI. Left ventricular hypertrophy. And they also note that there is insufficient evidence to order a microalbuminuria on all of our patients with high blood pressure. This year, they've lowered the recommendations for salt intake, 1,500 milligrams per day. Anybody have any idea how much salt is in a teaspoon? 2,100 milligrams. So it's three quarters of a teaspoon or less a day of salt. And where do you think you get the most salt from in our diet? Processed foods. Canned foods. If you ever look on a can of anything, it's usually preserved high in salt. Washing and rinsing out the vegetables out of that beforehand is usually a good idea. But lowering your salt intake can lower your blood pressure as well. And so again, 140 over 90, 130 over 80. Pretty straightforward. They used to have a 125 over 75, but they got rid of that out of the guidelines a few years ago. And which drugs to use? There are five first-line therapies, thiazide diuretics, ACEs, ARBs, calcium channel blockers, and a beta blocker, with the star next to the beta blocker saying that you shouldn't use it in people over the age of 60. And this is for non-compelling indications. There are other reasons why you would use these drugs besides just high blood pressure, but this is in all comers. So what's new for this year? Increasing emphasis on measuring blood pressure using devices in and out of the office. Lifestyle changes, increased emphasis on the use of single pill. So they're saying if you can use a combination pill, try it if you can, because that way it increases adherence to treatment. And they have a new website, hypertensionupdate.ca. Sodium intake went down, ARBs are equals to ACEs, and replace multiple pills with single pills. Any questions about high blood pressure? Yes.
The definition of hypertension, is it still 140 over 90?
It depends who you ask. And in the Canadian guidelines, they said that the upper limit that they would accept was 140 over 90 for all comers. If you had diabetes, 130 over 80. That doesn't mean that if your blood pressure is lower, you're not at risk of anything. In the Mr. Fit trial, which all the cardiologists will always quote, they never found a blood pressure where lower was not better than the higher number. And so 130 was better than 140, 120 was better than 130, 110 was better than 120. The problem was the asymptote really went up higher after 140 in terms of the risk of heart disease. And so that's why they set the 140 over 90 as the target. But people who are 130 to 140 are at high risk of developing hypertension in the next few years, so those are people that you might want to watch a little bit closer in terms of monitoring, but not necessarily in terms of medication. Lowering salt, eating healthy, doing physical activity should kind of be everybody's advice. If you need to use the blood pressure between 130 and 140 as your excuse for doing it, you can do it. Yeah?
So, first time, obviously, lifestyle changes. So, let's say the patient is still 145 over 90 after lifestyle modification, do you still start medication or do you wait for the 160?
Good question. So, no, you do start. They actually, in these guidelines, if you go through them, they actually talk about which ones to start with. So, they say between 140 and 160 over 90, if you do not have any end organ target damage and no risk factors for heart disease, you can use a few months of lifestyle modification. If not, anything above 140 over 90, you should treat. Diabetes, you should treat with medication. And the only caveat to that is they say 90% of people who have blood pressure over 140 over 90 have another risk factor for heart disease and should probably be treated anyway with medication. So once you actually diagnose it, it's very difficult to get out from the guidelines point of view from not treating them with medication. Most patients will. And even if they don't, which I think is great, you're going to end up doing it at some point in the future. So you might be delaying the inevitable. At this point, you have to decide, is this guideline applicable to my patient? So the cholesterol guidelines came out again recently, 2009 guidelines, and this is actually one of the ones that actually made some major changes compared to previous editions of the guideline. And they also managed to update this guideline about a week before one of my presentations in October. So again, I had to do this at the last minute, last time. So they recommend screening cholesterol for men over the age of 40 and women over the age of 50 or postmenopausal. That's when they say that you should start screening for cholesterol issues. There is a star next to that, and they say you could screen anybody at any at different ages depending on risk factors such as diabetes, high blood pressure, renal disease, current cigarette smoking. So any smoker, you could argue you should be checking their cholesterol. And children with the family history of hypercholesterolemia or chylomicronemia. If you also have a family member who, a patient who comes in and says, my uncle, my brother, my father, my sister, my dog all died at the age of 25 from heart disease, they're somebody you probably want to check their cholesterol as well. But this is where they actually changed a lot of the guidelines. And they used to have the risk factor ratio, which was your total cholesterol to HDL, and they kind of took it out of the guidelines now. And so basically what they said, for high risk, you want your LDL less than 2. If you're low risk, they want it less than 5. And for moderate risk, they want it less than 3.5. But then what they also did was your target changed. They wanted it less than 2 for high risk, less than 2 in moderate. This used to be 3.5. And for low risk, they want a 50% reduction of LDL. The other thing that changed was this, which is the high sensitivity CRP, which can be a marker of inflammation and a sign of a risk for heart disease. So people who are in this intermediate risk category with a Framingham score between 11 and 20%, you may consider treating them if they have a high sensitivity CRP, even if their LDL is less than 3.5. And so they put a whole bunch of things in this middle category that would help differentiate. And truthfully, I like this a lot because for low risk, it's very rare that you're going to treat them. What is the benefit? How long are you going to have to treat them for to save one person's life? In high risk, they're all pretty much all high risk, so you're probably going to treat them no matter what they have. It's that intermediate risk category where it was always gray, and they're trying to help clarify what to do with them. There is also some new comments about diabetes. It used to be if you had diabetes, you were automatically high risk. If you have diabetes with no signs of end organ damage, no other complications, you're probably not high risk, and you might be able to wait to put them on a statin no matter what. But as soon as they have some evidence of end organ damage, they feel that their risk is elevated, and you probably should treat them as high-risk patients. Any questions about cholesterol? You have a question? No? Okay. So pap tests. So I forgot to tell you a little bit about myself. I trained at McGill, and I did my residency here at the Jewish and Family Medicine. And then I left for Ottawa for 3 years and worked there for a couple of years. And then when my wife graduated from school, we moved back to Montreal, and I've been working here ever since. So you'll see some interspersing of some Ontario guidelines in here because that's kind of what I used for 3 years. And they happen to also be one of the most up-to-date ones in the country. So these are the ones we're going to use. So pap tests. In Quebec, we do not have a pap test program. We do not have a cervical cancer screening program the way we do a mammogram program, the way that in some provinces they have it all organized. There is a consensus guideline from the SOGC in 2007 that summarizes all the Canadian ones, but the most up-to-date provincial guideline is the Ontario one from 2005, and so that's the one that I pretty much use. And so if you look at the guidelines, only Prince Edward Island and I think it was Saskatchewan had an age where they started automatically. So they did all people over a certain age. Everywhere else now, it's been changed to after sexual debut, and in Ontario, it's within 3 years after onset of sexual activity. And that doesn't mean you don't talk to your patients, but you don't have to necessarily do a pap test until they've been 3 years out. And this doesn't obviate the need for sexually transmitted infection screening, because that could be the few days after you've had intercourse, whereas a pap test might only be necessary a few years later. And they say anything that touches the vaginal area with anything other than one's own body. So any vaginal digital, vaginal oral, vaginal intercourse, anything of the sorts, and you should be tested within 3 years. And you do it annually until you have had 3 negative paps, at which point you can skip 1 or 2 years. So do it every 2 to 3 years. And you can stop when you turn 70 if you've had normal screening in the previous 10 years. How long does it take for HPV to become cancerous, typically? What's the natural history? Because that's actually what this is based on. I got a vote for 20 years. I got a vote for 10. Anybody else? Typically 12 to 15 years. It takes a long time to go from infection, dysplasia, to cancer. And so you do have time. Also, when you're younger, you're much, much, much more likely to revert back to normal. And so if your body's able to clear it without having any dysplasia, then there is obviously no need to worry about cancer. So then what to do if you have an abnormal result? So atypical squamous cells of unknown significance, or ASCUS, they say if you're young, you repeat again in 6 months. If it's anything other than normal, you go straight to colposcopy. If you're over the age of 30, they say you could do an HPV DNA testing, and if it shows a high risk, you go to colposcopy. If it's normal, you just screen again. HPV DNA testing has to be done on the liquid prep cytology. In Ontario, that's actually the standard of care. You don't do the wood stick with the spatula thing in Ontario. It's only liquid-based. So if you want to add it, all you do is call the lab, and it's added onto the sample, but the patient has to pay for it. In Quebec, if you don't do a liquid prep to begin with, you have to redo the test. Does it really change anything? I'm not entirely sure for ASCUS. For low sill, it's the same thing. You repeat again in 6 months. Pretty much for everything else, besides normal, you go to colposcopy. And again, you still have a lot of time to react. The risk of developing cancer in the next month or two is very low. So you have the time. Any questions? We're flying through this, hopefully. Quick and easy. Asthma. So asthma's guidelines are actually quite old. Anything that's above 5 years with a guideline is kind of out of date. This is not the oldest guideline. Osteoporosis is pretty bad, and breast cancer screening mammography is insane. It's from 1994. But the asthma guidelines are still what we have to work with. And when you look at the updates of it, especially in kids and everything, they're very similar, but with a little bit of tweak. So we'll talk a little bit about that. So asthma has a long-winded definition, but basically it means reversible airway disease. And the guidelines say that you should need your Ventolin rescue less than 4 times per week. This is one of the guidelines which I don't totally agree with and totally practice. There are, if you ask the respirologist, they target less than 1 or less than 2 requirements of Ventolin per week, but the Canadian guidelines still say less than 4. You should not be waking up at night, though, to cough or because you can't breathe. You should be able to do normal physical activity. You shouldn't have any exacerbation. You shouldn't miss work or school ever for any reason. And you shouldn't need your beta agonist. And that's not including pre-exercise doses. Pre-exercise doses don't count. If you need it before exercise, that's okay. Rescue doses that they target. And if you do have asthma, there is an asthma pyramid that I suggest everybody uses. Always start with the environmental first. I'm allergic to cats. I live with 22 cats. No matter how much medication you're giving somebody, odds are they're going to have symptoms. So environmental action plan always comes first, and then you always start with a short-acting beta agonist. There are some indications and some people that will use the long-acting beta agonists. I'm still a traditionalist, and I will always start with the short-acting. Then you can go up and start with steroids. Anybody American here? Okay, good. Americans are very steroid-phobic as a population, and so their steroids are not as popularly used as they are here in Canada, but we do advocate, and even the Americans advocate for inhaled corticosteroids. And then you can do an add-on therapy, which would be a long-acting beta agonist or a leukotriene receptor antagonist, such as Singulair. And then after that, you can add things like prednisone, Xolair, some of the other fancier stuff that I don't usually order, especially not on a chronic basis. Any questions about asthma? So remember, less than 4 exacerbations per week is what the goal is in Canada. Osteoporosis. So this is another older one from 2002, and the 2010 guidelines that will come out this year for osteoporosis is an update. I don't know what they'll be, but I know this talk will be updated then, and so should all of our knowledges. Basically, anybody who's been taking prednisone for more than 7.5 milligrams a day for more than 3 months should be on a bone-sparing agent regardless of their bone density. So there are a lot of patients who have Crohn's or colitis who end up being on long-term steroids. They really need to be a bone-sparing agent. One of my good friends, his mother had a T-score of -6 because of chronic use of prednisone. And it took the 5th or 6th vertebral fracture before somebody said, oh, maybe we should be doing something. That being said, anybody who has a fragility fracture after the age of 40, you have to consider doing a bone density on. Anybody with one major or two minor risk factors, which we'll go through in a minute, at age 50 should get a bone density. And anybody who has a low bone density, you should consider therapy. So, what are the major and minor risk factors? So, age over 65 is an automatic, which basically means that everybody, by the time they hit their 65th birthday, should have a bone density done. Vertebral compression fracture or maternal osteoporotic fracture, especially a hip or a family history of osteoporotic fracture, especially a maternal hip, is a high risk and should get you out through the age of 50. Early menopause before age 45. Not before age 50. What's the average age of menopause?
51.
So 50 is not that far off. And then there's the minor risk factors, which include everything from smoking and drinking to being a very tiny old woman. Although at 50, they're not old. Don't call a 50-year-old woman old. That's really, really mean. Any question about osteoporosis?
You were saying that anyone who's been on chronic steroids, you would treat them regardless.
Yes.
Even if their bone mineral density is lovely?
Yes.
Okay.
If you're putting someone on prednisone and you say you're going to be on 20 milligrams of prednisone probably for the next 6 months, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Because even if their bone density is okay now, what's it going to be like in a year from now? And you know that prednisone is such a high risk for osteoporosis, you are supposed to be on a bone-sparing agent. And it's an easy one. It's something that's relatively easy compared to hip surgery. So diabetes, my bread and butter. This is my favorite guideline, and we're going to spend a little bit of time on this one because there's not that many slides, but the information is important. So these guidelines were updated in 2008, and the reason why they came out a little bit late, they came out in October, and they're supposed to come out in March, and the reason is because there's a big trial going on, and it was because of this one trial that they changed the guidelines. And so we're going to talk about how that impacted it. So how do you diagnose diabetes? There are three ways to diagnose diabetes officially. You have to have a fasting plasma glucose above 7, preferably on more than one occasion, after fasting for more than 8 hours. If you have 7.5, 7.2, you have diabetes, congratulations, go home. No need to do anything else. If you do a random blood sugar, and it is 14.2, and the person says, I'm having polyuria, polydipsia, polyphagia, they most likely have diabetes, and technically you can diagnose them and treat them. Most people would probably want a fasting sugar after that point, no matter what, but that is enough to diagnose diabetes. And then the third way is 2-hour oral glucose tolerance test. Has anybody ever tasted the oral glucose tolerance test solution? It's 75 grams of the sweetest orange crush you've ever had in your entire lives. It's not exactly the most pleasant test to go through, but if you do it, you'll survive. And if you have a blood sugar above 11.1, or equal to, on a 2-hour oral glucose tolerance test, you have diabetes. Any questions about what the diagnosis of diabetes? Because this is diabetes. And one of my problems with diabetes is either you have diabetes or you don't. Because it's almost like saying, are you pregnant or not? And being almost pregnant doesn't really make sense. But there are these in-betweens for diabetes. And those are impaired fasting glucose and impaired glucose tolerance. And so between 6 and 7, you don't have diabetes, but you're not normal. You have what's called impaired fasting glucose. Impaired glucose tolerance is when you eat and your body doesn't handle sugar perfectly, but it's not as bad as somebody with diabetes. And for impaired glucose tolerance, anything between 7.8 and 11 is diabetes. It's impaired glucose tolerance. Very confusing, right? So then the question becomes, who do you order an oral glucose tolerance test on? What do people think? What do you think? Who would you order an oral glucose tolerance test on?
Someone with a high random glucose.
A high random glucose? Sure. Who else? They do a slightly different one. They do a 50 gram and they're not fasting. And their target, their values are a little bit different.
If the fasting was between 6.1 and 6.9.
Yes. Anybody else? You would oral glucose tolerance test?
Can't fast.
Sorry, someone who can fast. Well, typically for the glucose tolerance test, you still fast for 8 hours to start. You still do a fasting first. For the pregnant women, we don't. But for people who go for a normal fast, oral glucose tolerance, they come in fasting. So actually, they say every year you should see if you deserve to be tested for diabetes. And that at age 40, every 3 years, you should be tested for diabetes. And this is a grade D consensus. So this is a bunch of experts sitting in a room deciding that this is good for your health. And then who do you want to do an oral glucose tolerance test on? So if you have a first-degree relative with diabetes, high-risk population, history of gestational diabetes, hypertension, if you have a really big baby when they're born, people with polycystic ovarian syndrome, acanthosis, nigra cans, or schizophrenia, these are people who you might consider doing a two-hour glucose tolerance test because they have a higher chance of having diabetes. At the same time, if your plasma glucose is between 6 and 7, you should. If it's above 5.6, though, you actually are also supposed to consider it, especially if they have individuals with risk factors. If your blood sugar is above 5.6 fasting, you should consider doing an oral glucose tolerance test. And I can tell you, practically speaking, I've picked up quite a few number of patients who've had 2 hours of 13 and 14 when their fasting sugars is 5.9, 6.2, 6.1. Yeah. So if you're between 6 and 7, you have impaired fasting glucose, right? But if your two-hour test is less than 7.8, that's normal. So after 2 hours of doing this test, if your sugar is 7.6, that's a normal test. If it's between 7.8 and 11, you have impaired glucose tolerance. Above 11.1, you have diabetes. It is confusing, and it is challenging to memorize these numbers off the top, and I know it's kind of artificial to ask people questions like that. But if you look at the lab test results, they actually don't always put what you actually use practically. In our blood tests here at the hospital, anything above 5.5 for a sugar is abnormal. It'll get flagged as high. It doesn't necessarily interpret it for you the way that you probably should. These guidelines, diabetes.ca. Very easy. No matter where you are in the world, you can find them. So then the question becomes is what is our treatment? And this is kind of where that study kind of changed the guidelines. These are the guidelines for now for diabetes. We want your fasting blood sugar to be between 4 and 7, your A1C to be less than 7%, in your 2 hours, we want it less than 10, unless your A1C is not less than 7, in which case, if you can do it safely, less than 8. The old guidelines actually were more aggressive, and they said if you can, ideally target less than 6% for your A1C. Target normal blood sugars, 4 to 6, less than 8, 2 hours. And the reason why they took that out of the guidelines is because in this one trial, they found an increased mortality rate in people who were tightly controlled. And so this is where I tell, I guess my joke, but I tell patients I have two rules, one for patients, one for doctors. The rule for patients, you can go bungee jumping, you can go skydiving, you can go for a walk in the park. You're not allowed to fall and break your hip. Rule for doctors, don't kill your patients. Seems quite simple. But sometimes what we do can be a little bit over-aggressive, and we don't want to do too much. We want to prevent illness, not cause it. And so in order to treat diabetes, there are a whole bunch of pharmacologic agents that are out there. You have your alpha-glucosidase inhibitors, your insulin secretagogues like the sulfonylureas, your TZDs, and the one we almost always start with is metformin, your big one eye. And there's a new one, the DPP-4 inhibitor, which, do you know what that's called? See, there are ads for it on TV now. Do you know what it's called? It's called Januvia. It's the new one. I believe it is a molecule that was isolated from the saliva of a Gila monster. Go figure. Which, and then of course there's always insulin. Which of these treatments are associated with weight loss? What's your first line therapy? Sorry?
Diet.
Yes. No, no, but what drug therapy is your first one? Metformin. Which one do you think causes weight loss? Metformin. Metformin is the only one that's associated with weight loss. All the other ones tend to make you gain weight. The newer ones, the DPP-4 is weight neutral, and they say that the alpha-glucosidase is also weight neutral. But the TZDs can definitely make you gain weight, and so can the insulin secretagogues. Insulin as well. I'm going to skip that. So vaccines.
So, sorry, yeah. So
what do you do for your impaired fasting? Good question. What would you do for your impaired fasting glucose patient? So diet, definitely. People who have impaired fasting glucose and impaired glucose tolerance have a high risk of developing diabetes, first of all. Second of all, they're also at risk pretty early on for the macrovascular complications of diabetes. And so you really want to make sure their blood pressure is well under control. There used to be a huge push to treat all of these patients with some sort of pharmacotherapy to prevent diabetes, hoping that if you treat them for it beforehand, A, you can prevent diabetes, and B, prevent the complications. It's very hard to prove that you can prevent complications in this group because their rates are not quite as high as people with diabetes, so you need a large number of patients for a long time to prove benefit. And so there are not a lot of good studies. Historically, I was a lot more aggressive with it before, and then they came out with some trials that actually showed that you might be harming some of your patients. And so if someone I really truly believe is diabetic and is just borderline, I'll treat them with metformin. If not, I will be fairly aggressive with the diet and exercise and closely monitoring them for developing diabetes. But you can give them metformin or alpha-glucosidase inhibitors at that point to try and prevent the onset, but I don't know if you're just preventing the inevitable and just treating diabetes early. Vaccine schedules. These change frequently, so this is one of the ones that often you got to keep up to date on. This is the schedule for Quebec, and it changes for every province, and so wherever you should practice in the future, in the States, they do things differently. Everywhere in the world, they do it slightly differently, but it's all a variation on the same theme. But at 12 months, we give meningitis, measles, mumps, rubella with chickenpox now. It used to be two shots, now we can give one. You get the pneumonia shot, and those are the four you get now at 12 months. The PDSL, you get it 2, 4, 6, and 18. And the recent changes to this are that in grade 4 in Quebec now, the students are getting two doses of Twinrix, actually. So they get hepatitis A and B. It used to be just hep B, now they're giving hep A and B. And the HPV vaccine, which you get in grade 4 to grade 9, and anybody under the age of 18 is eligible to get. Yes?
So is it everyone under 18 at the time where you see them, or there's an actual birthday, which differs by the year of birth?
No, it's by if you we don't actually get them in the offices. They give it only to the CLSCs, the vaccine. So if your patient is under the age of 18, then they can give it to them. If you're over the age of 18, they say, ask your doctor for a prescription, and you can buy it at the pharmacy for $150 to $160 about, and get three doses. I like the concept of the vaccine. My philosophy of vaccines is they're there to prevent death, and cancer kills people. And cervical cancer is, for all intents and purposes, a sexually transmitted infection. And if you have not caught said sexually transmitted infection and you are potentially going to be exposed to it in the future with a new partner, the reasons not to get it don't really add up to me. And so I'm a big fan of it, even if the woman is 24 years old, 23 years old. I don't think it doesn't change whether or not you need a pap test or not. It just is there to decrease the likelihood of cancer. Yes, it can reduce warts as well, but I give it so that it prevents cancer. Would I give a vaccine just for genital warts? Probably not. Or would I advocate it? No, but I would definitely advocate it because of the cancer part of it. Oh, and the other change is that they added chickenpox. It's very nice. My daughter's 14 months old, and she only gets one instead of two shots. I think it's very polite. Mammograms. So this, again, is a very old guideline from 1994. And for those of you who've been reading the newspaper, watching TV, about a few months ago, there was a lot of discussion in the States about what to do with mammograms. And the Americans actually use a very different guidelines. And a lot of American populations will start between the ages of 35 and 40. But in Canada, between the ages of 50 and 69, there is good evidence that using mammograms saves your life, or can potentially save your life. And so therefore, it's a grade A recommendation from 1994, and it still holds true today, which is why most provinces in Canada have a mammogram program between the age of 50 and 70, and every 2 years you would go for a mammogram. That doesn't mean you don't get a mammogram before or after 50 and 70, but this is where the most bang for your buck exists and where there's good evidence that it will make a difference in your life. Between the ages of 40 and 49, it's a grade C recommendation that you should have a discussion with your doctor as to the risks and benefits of this procedure and to see if it's right for you. Prior to menopause, breast density is such that mammograms don't give you a very good picture. So this is not if you feel a lump, do or don't do a mammogram. This is if you don't have any signs of anything, should you just go for a mammogram anyway just to check? Given that it's such a poor quality film and not that diagnostic, the evidence doesn't suggest that you're more likely to save your life. It might mean that you get a false sense of security from saying, no, we didn't see anything, or you get worried about something that's actually non-existent. And so the mammogram in this age group hasn't been shown to be good for your health. Now, it depends if you're a radiologist or a breast surgeon or someone who has a family member with breast cancer, but for in general, for the vast majority of patients between the ages of 40 and 50, the evidence that it's good for them is low. And so for this age group, it's a risk-benefit calculation that you have to apply the guideline to your patient. Any questions about mammograms? So, this last topic, while I was in Ottawa, I worked at the sexual health clinic, and so this is an homage to that type of my part of my life where we saw this 20 times a day. And now in Quebec, they're advertising on the radio that there are increasing rises of STDs and that patients and people should be aware of the risks. So, urethritis / cervicitis. In men, they usually complain of discharge, burning, unexplained pyuria. I've yet to meet a man who would look down and see pus and say, oh, that's normal. They tend to come to your attention. Women, on the other hand, don't necessarily always know that they have an STI, especially chlamydia. They can be quite asymptomatic, but they can have discharge, lower abdominal pain, intermenstrual bleeding. I've yet to meet a woman who does their own cervical exam to know that they have mucopurulent cervical discharge, but they can. And the most common causes are chlamydia, gonorrhea, trich, and HSV. In a woman who consistently has symptoms or has what looks like it and you don't grow anything on your chlamydia and gonorrhea culture, think of HSV. In men, you can do the Q-tip in the penis test, but now most places actually have the PCR test so that you can pee in a cup first 15 to 30 cc's, and it's pretty good for detecting chlamydia and gonorrhea by PCR. For women, you can do it as well. However, it is more sensitive, especially if you have higher suspicion, to do a cervical swab. The other disadvantage with doing a PCR is you don't get sensitivities. You just get yes or no. And so if you are contemplating treatment and you don't know if it's resistant or not, a PCR might not necessarily be what you are looking for. And the treatment. My personal treatment of choice is Suffixing 400 and Azithro 1 gram. If a man comes in with discharge and I don't have a gram stain that tells me you have gram-negative diplococci or not on the gram stain immediately, I treat them for both. And it's a two single dose treatments that basically gets both bugs right away. You can use doxycycline twice a day for 7 days, but again, historically, this is a very unreliable population. I had strep throat about 3-4 years ago. It was one of the most single painful experiences of my adult life. And I consider myself to be pretty reliable. I put myself, or my colleague put me on Pen-V, 600 milligrams twice a day for 10 days. I still missed two doses. And I'd like to think I was treating myself properly. So for STIs, when people are treating them, are getting treated and then trying to prevent the spread, single doses usually are much more compliant related. Treat all partners within the past 60 days or the last partner. My record for a patient complaining of or being diagnosed with chlamydia and not having intercourse was 3 years. She claimed she hadn't had anybody touch her for 3 years, and yet she was chlamydia positive. So he had to get tested. And you haven't treated an STD until you've treated their partner. How long after treatment before they should have sex again? For chlamydia and gonorrhea. If that were the case, nobody would have STDs.
72 hours?
A week, generally. A week afterwards, you can have intercourse. Theoretically, yes, you can use a condom. I still am not a big fan of it. I don't trust anybody. No, people don't use things properly, so I say a week. How soon before you can test to see if you've it actually worked? So these are PCR tests, which tell you if you have DNA or not. It doesn't tell you whether or not the organisms are alive or dead. Chlamydia is an intracellular parasite, so it actually sticks around a little bit longer. So it's usually within about 4 weeks. So generally, you actually don't retest unless you're at high risk, if you're pregnant, if you are engaging in risky behavior in between, or if you still have symptoms, that might be an indication to check again. But for the most part, you don't. Any questions about STIs?
Is there any reason you ever treat with
doxycycline? PID. PID is classically when I would do it. Allergy to medication. But typically, Cefixime 400, Azithro 1 gram, it's so easy. You can even watch them swallow it in your office if you have it. The 16-year-old who comes in with it. Okay. In Quebec, if you write code K on the prescription, it's free. K is for the person in front of you. Code L is for their lover. And so that will get them covered the prescription for free. But it also identifies them to the pharmacist that, yes, they had an STD. But usually the single dose of Cefixime or Azithro also does, so it doesn't really matter. Any questions about any of the guidelines? No? Okay, so thank you very much. And, yeah, this is me. We're done.